Talk about this comic.
We're gonna talk about comics from Devil's Due. It's something you wondered if Talking Joe would ever do. I guess we'll explain it all to you. Gonna take some time to read the books we've never read. Oh, oh.
Hey, 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 it's me, Mark, and welcome to Talking Joe, the G.I. Joe Comics podcast. Today, we will be continuing our adventure into the mini-series and one-shots that were coming out during the America's Elite Disavowed era. Today, it is the turn of Special Missions Antarctica from Devil's Due, December 2006, which was collected in the trade paperback of G.I. Joe Special Missions from a Devil's Due in March 2007. And joining me to give these books a frosty reception, as usual, it's my co-host, it's a real American Tim, it's Tim Finn.
Hello, listeners, and hello, Mark, and hello to this snowman that's next to me as I make some hilarious reference to the Antarctican setting of this comic book. I'm inside. There's no snowman next to me. Let's talk about this comic.
Okay. So this came out sort of towards the end of the run of America's Elite from Joe Casey. So a sort of a side adventure as they're wrapping up there. It was a one-shot, 48 pages. The cover price was $4.95. And was, as I say, collected alongside some of the other Special Missions one-shots. So it's split into two. So I think we'll probably cover each of the two short stories one after the other. So we'll mix our order up a little bit. And let's start with the cover, Tim.
Let's have a look at the covers in the gallery.
Okay. The cover to Special Missions Antarctica, there is only one cover. There are no variants, which I love for several reasons. On a book that's longer than normal and is a buck or two more than normal, that's a relief. Also, I've talked about this in some previous episodes, but maybe not in a long time. It's worth repeating. I feel that if you have a variant cover or many variant covers, the power of the A cover, the normal cover, is diminished because it can't possibly elevate and achieve sort of, it's less likely to achieve iconic status, you know, like G.I. Joe 53 from Marvel by Mike Zeck with the 25th anniversary Marvel border, snake eyes, badass, head, shoulders, hand, oozy yellow background, right? G.I. Joe number one, 1982. If that had shipped with seven other covers, you know, like one with the Baroness in her blue costume with the yellow shoulders, like standing in a random forest. Anyway, okay, G.I. Joe Special Missions Antarctica. The cover is by Francis Manapul, who is best known in the Devil's Due G.I. Joe world for the variant covers for Dreadnoughts Declassified, which we've talked about, and his covers for G.I. Joe Declassified, which we have not yet talked about. Those are both triptychs. This Antarctica is a single regular cover, and it is a great drawing. There's a very strong diagonal going from the top left down to the bottom right as three Joes heroically and in something of a panic defend themselves against original snow serpents and a Crimson Guards man during not just a big storm, because there's snow falling all around them, but also what looks like an avalanche as there's some roiling, tumbling snow coming at them in the top left and just above Snake Eyes' head. And I love this cover. There's a lot of negative space, right? A third of the background under the logo is just the distant sky with a lot of busy snow in front of it. And then in the distance, there's a mountain. And there's some subtle sort of color differentiation where the distant sky behind the logo is slightly reddish purple. And the distant mountain, which is behind Snowjob, is, I can't quite tell what the cast on it is. I think it may just be sort of a neutral gray. And then the snow generally around all the foreground characters has a little bit of light blue in it. So there are some color differences to help separate these major elements. Snake Eyes' pose, he's almost falling backwards. He's holding two machine guns, which is sort of unrealistic and silly, but also really cool. Covers can just be cool exaggerations. Snowjob's pose is just an excellent example of a dynamic contrapposto pose where his spine is twisting and his weight is on one leg and his other leg is counterbalancing and his foreground arm is sweeping and curling back as he reacts. Scarlet's pose is a tiny bit awkward, but I actually think that works because the mountain is coming down around them.
And the snow serpent is grabbing her crossbow and sort of pulling her.
Yes.
Kind of at an awkward angle.
Yes, thank you. The way that Manipul draws the actual snowflakes, like on the bottom left around the UPC barcode and sort of just above the snow serpent who is grabbing Scarlet's weapon and just to the left of the Devil's Due symbol, reminds me of how Chris Bachalo draws snow. And he has drawn a lot of snow. I think he did some in this year's Free Comic Book Day Night Terrors promo story for DC. And he did some issues of Spider-Man, Amazing Spider-Man, during the mega Brand New Day story. They become sort of flat and abstract as if they've been cut out of index cards, not like crystalline snowflakes or like, you know, sort of little clumpy snowballs. There is one thing about this cover that doesn't work for me. And that is within the half of it where a lot of people are. Manipul has, I think, inked some of the characters with a wash, with a watered down ink to get a gray tone. You can see it definitely all over Snowjob, but I think you can also see it sort of under the blue of Snake Eyes and on the snow serpents. And that combined with a little bit of rendering in the colors, to me actually makes the half of this cover that is characters fighting and struggling a little busy. I have a slightly hard time sort of telling the snow serpent who's grabbing Scarlet's weapon. I can see what he's doing. I can see like where one hand is, the other hand, his shoulder, his leg, his knee. But I get a little lost in sort of the details of his like fur trim and his pouches and his helmet and then the three snow serpents up top with the Crimson Guardsmen. And I have thought this about this cover since it originally came out and well before you and I were going to actually sit down and read this for this episode. I kept seeing this image very small on my computer because I was looking it up online, like, oh, what comic are we reading for our next issue? I got to go pull it out of a box. And my sort of evidence for how this cover is like slightly over-inked and over-colored, despite Manipul being a great artist and designer, is how this cover becomes a little bit of a murky mess when you look at it small. So do you like this cover, Mark?
I love this cover. This is one of my favorite of the Devil's Due covers. Maybe my second most favorite of the Devil's Due covers. As you say, it sort of really puts me in mind of Chris Bachalo. And yeah, I think it looks great. It's sort of really muscular, lot of sort of kinetic energy, all of these elements combined, the diagonal on it. It really stands out as apart from a lot of the other covers. I had one other observation as well, is that the background to the cover with all of the falling snow, the element that was put in by the colorist behind the snow that was drawn originally by Francis Manipul, really puts me in mind of the cover to Sin City, Silent Night, which came out in 1995. Sort of very sort of similar kind of almost painterly kind of effect of the falling snow sort of blurring out in the background.
Yeah, that was a one shot.
Was probably Varley color.
Absolutely. That was a one shot, that Sin City comic. And yes, I think what we're seeing here behind Manipul's snow on the top right is actual white paint that's been scanned in and added, or actual like black paint that's been scanned in and inverted. And it's possible that it was painted in a program like Painter. I don't know that Photoshop brushes were good enough in 2006 to pull off this effect. But that's a neat statement that this is one of your favorite or one of the strongest of all the Devil's Due covers. I hadn't thought of it that way. I think I agree. Oh, one other thing. I also appreciate, as an old school Joe fan, that though there are a mixture of characters inside the book, the cover has version one of the Snow Serpents and version one of the Crimson Guardsmen. That, you know, because it's an invented scene, because it's an exaggeration, you could have version two of the Snow Serpents, or you could have a mix. You could have version two of the Crimson Guardsmen. All right, inside.
Okay, so the first story, Special Missions Antarctica, was brought to us by the team of writer Andrew Dabb, pencils Tim Seeley, inks Robert Q. Atkins, colours Jean-Francois Beaulieu, letters Brian J. Crowley, and editor Mike O'Sullivan. I'll just note that this is the same art team as the previous Special Missions Tokyo, with the exception of the writer on that one, which was Rob Rohde. This is from Andrew Dabb, who was the writer on the Sigma 6 series. Right, so let's do a quick plot briefing for this one.
Plot breakdown.
Cobra has discovered a huge oil reserve under Antarctica and is illegally mining it. General Colton and Sparks assemble a team to attack the refinery. They send Duke, Stalker, Snake Eyes and Scarlet to meet up with Frostbite, Iceberg and Snowjob. Using the Snowcat and Polar Bear, their team just beats a blizzard as they approach the refinery. They make a plan. One half of the team will destroy the refinery and create a distraction, while Snake Eyes and Snowjob go to capture Tomax and Zaymot. Snake Eyes and Snowjob disguise themselves as Crimson Guardsmen. They sneak into the room where Tomax was, but he makes an escape on a claw and is pursued by the Joes. Outside, the rest of the Joes have successfully blown up the refinery, but are overcome by Cobras. Snake Eyes and Snowjob abandon their chase of Tomax to go save the trapped Joes. They jump in an earth drilling machine and come under the attacking Cobras, which clears the way for the team to evacuate. Support comes later and the entire refinery is disabled and the Cobras are captured. As the wrap-up continues, the team is sent a message that a Cobra cell has been discovered in Hawaii and that their support is needed. It's the opposite of out of the frying pan and into the fire. It's out of something very cold and into something very warm. Tim, what did you think of this one?
I thought it was fun. It felt like an episode of the cartoon because of how much action there was. It was sort of peppy, and there's some jokey lines that maybe we would get in a regular Devil's Due issue, but I don't think we would get in a Larry Hama issue. The art and coloring definitely lean closer to the animated series of the 1980s. Colorist Beaulieu is coloring with hard edges, no rendering on the characters, and in a cel-shaded style, basically. You know, even down to Joe's disguising themselves as Cobras, that's something that we see, I think, more often in the cartoon than in the Larry Hama comic. So lots of fun. I'm always happy to see not just one Arctic guy, but many. Also, I think in terms of it feeling more like an episode or a Devil's Due issue that is straddling the animated continuity and the continued Marvel continuity, I think if it were a Larry Hama script, there would be something in the discussion of how oil is extracted or transported or how a storm works that would be more specific and sort of sciency or educational, like sort of brainy. And this is not a criticism of Andrew Dabb's script. I think part of what makes this skip along is how it doesn't spend a lot of time on, you know, it's like, you know, like, well, we have to get under the third leg of this tripod oil drill because the first two are at a 15 degree angle on the incline and the weight puts it, the bomb will be more effective on the, you know, the third one. Like the things that I like about a Hama script also make it very much a Hama script.
Mm. Yeah, it was, it's, you know, very bright and breezy, a lot of action. The art is strong. We enjoyed the team when they were working on Special Missions Tokyo and sort of when we talked about it then, again, it was sort of putting us in mind of that more sort of animated feel to it. It's, always cool to kind of see a team of specialists sort of working together. You know, it's not something necessarily completely new. We do have seen other similar issues with Arctic guys working together, but it's always a lot of fun to see those specialists grouping up and going on a mission that leans into their speciality. And in terms of the actual story itself, you know, we do start in media res with then a sort of a flashback. So, you know, starting in the middle of things and then, but how did we get to here? Which is fine, but the rest of it was much more sort of a straightforward story and very easy to follow, which was a little bit of a breath of fresh air compared to the last couple of issues that we've discussed where we're sort of jumping about here and there and everywhere with the flashbacks.
Is there anything about this story which doesn't work for you? If the answer is no, then that's great. I'm not fishing for negativity. I know our Devil's Due episodes sometimes hover in marinade in negativity.
These aren't negatives, but there were probably two questions that were prompted by this. The first of which was, hold on, What's the deal with Tomax and Zaymot again? And so I had to sort of have a think about where was the last time we saw Tomax and Zaymot, and why is Tomax on his own? The answer to that question is that Tomax and Zaymot were last seen, I believe, in issue 41, which was sort of in the middle of the Red Shadows storyline back from April 2005, so almost 2 years before this one came out. And in that story, we saw Tomax and Zaymot in a cave with Della Eden preparing to shoot them. You'll never leave here alive. So obviously at least one of them from this story has made it out alive. But it sort of prompts the question then, where is Zaymot? And we get a bit of an answer to that without having to wait too long, because it's kind of addressed at the end of the next story in this book. And then the second question that I had was, in terms of the success of the Joe mission, I thought to myself, are the Joes the good guys here? Are these guys environmental terrorists? Is leaving behind, is blowing up an oil refinery and leaving the burning oil, smoking away up into the sky, is that a successful outcome?
Well, there's a line of dialogue from Stalker on page 30, the final page of the story. He says, well, we trashed everything and did a ton of damage, but we're leaving. So the story's over now. Turn the page. Wait, no. What he says is, the Army Corps of Engineers should have these wells capped in a few days. Cleaning up this mess will take a while, but once we do, it'll be like Cobra was never here. So, indeed. Yes, a little convenient, but at least there is some explanation for how, you know, things will be ameliorated by someone else in a story that we will never read. Like, you know, you could be reading some Marvel crossover and they trash a city, and then someone says, well, damage control will fix this. And then we never have to read about it. And then an issue or a year later, the city is back to normal. Although 50-50 chance Marvel would publish a miniseries where damage control does show up and fix that city, and then all sorts of interesting things happen.
Another question mark that I had in my head, which I said, you know, suspension of disbelief, let's just go with this story, was some of the physics of this story. So there's an element where Stalker gets his, you know, combat knife, whacks it a hole in a oil pipeline with his knife, all in one go. It's, you know, knife through butter. And then as the oil is gushing out, he sets it alight with his lighter, his Zippo lighter, sort of scaring away the cobras that are chasing after him. And I thought, that sounds like a high risk maneuver.
Yes, when I got to that scene, actually, you know what I thought when I got to that scene? I sort of thought what you just said, but I also thought, would a lighter be enough? Is there something about this? So I admit to not being a pyromaniac, and I sort of experimented with that feeling for like one half hour when I was a kid. We had a fire going in our fireplace, and we had like put the mail, the junk mail aside, you know, to be recycled with the newspapers. And, you know, we could put little bits of paper under the logs to make the fire either start faster or spread in the fireplace. And I grabbed one of the catalogs and tore a page off and put it just on the fire and watched the colors turn to brown and the paper warp as the beautiful licks of fire spread across it. And it was fascinating. And I, for the next like little while, just tore page after page after page of that catalog and some magazine and another catalog. And then I realized I was sort of smothering the fire, and this is not a good sort of mental habit to get into. So I don't actually know what liquids ignite easily, you know, like lighter fluid, yes. Beer and wine, I don't think so. Gasoline, yes. Oil, yes. But what kind of oil is flowing in this pipe? Is it crude? Like, I know that oil rigs and oil refineries can have fires, but do you need something more than a Zippo lighter to actually get it to start? And that felt like maybe one of those sort of simplifications or contractions where if this had been a script by a different writer, there may have been a little bit of an explanation, you know, about how this is going to work, how they're going to get this to work, or a little bit of an explanation like, that might be a terrible idea. Sorry, got to do it.
Yeah. In my mind, crude oil is very flammable. Okay. And so I don't disbelieve the lighter burning it. My sort of thought process was more along the lines of, would it just create that sort of gush of fire that scares off the troopers, or would it spread and sort of explode the entire pipeline and destroy the entire complex along with all of everyone that's there? But the other thing that, again, I thought to myself, let's go with this, suspend disbelief, was the fighting style of some of the cobras, which seemed to be that they would overwhelm the Joes by just running at them and jumping on them.
That felt sort of like, I'm not saying this is what happened, it felt sort of like there was some limitation imposed, like the bad guys can't use guns in every scene.
Perhaps.
Or, well, I this scene has to be done in three panels, and I can't have a lot of back and forth with blam, 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 rat, tat, tat. That bit did seem underdeveloped, or you'd have to lay track for it. Like, you know, if you had a scene earlier in the comic where a couple of the snow serpents are playing cards inside, and one of them says something like, you know, we never see any action. All we do is target practice with our rifles. I want to box. I want to wrestle. I want to take the enemy down with my bare hands, right? And then several pages later, like, let's rush him. Oh, it's that guy.
Mm. Or maybe they've been told that they can't have live fire because of the explosive risk around the oil refinery.
Yes.
But, you know, and a lot of them are holding weapons.
And you could solve that. You could have that as dialogue, or you could also have a sign. You know, a little
sign,
like,
no guns.
Helpful 1950s sort of cartoony clip art Cobra Commander. Like, now remember, no live fire in the oil fields.
There's a bit where Snake Eyes and Snowjob are attacked by snow serpents. Tomax is running away. He says, "Snow serpents, stop the Joes." And they sort of emerge from the snow as if they've been sort of buried there in this sort of abandoned, you know, in this isolated pathway for goodness knows how long, waiting for the Joes to appear.
You know why I'm okay with this? Because the desert scorpions do that in the Deke episodes.
Yeah, it's a very kind of cartoon idea and visual. And it's, you know, it's like, cool. But also, this makes no sense.
How long have you been there? It's like, all right, I need, it's Wednesday and it's 10 a.m. and I need you all to dig little trenches for yourselves, and I'm going to bury you. Or what? Bury the person on your left, and then you jump in your trench, and then the guy on your left buries you. And in 18 days, if no one has happened to walk by who needs to be ambushed, I will come feed you. folks, if you're not familiar with the Deke episodes, don't remember offhand what episode it is, but it makes the theme song. That clip makes the theme song. So you can just watch the theme song. That also happens in, a version of this happens in Indiana Jones and the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull, when Indy and Mutt go to, I forget, somewhere in South America, and they go into, I forget, some kind of sort of, you know, like Mayan or Aztec, like, temple thing. And they're looking for, I forget, like a map or a stone or a gem or something. And these, like, guys just come out of the walls. Mm. And I think in the Raiders of the Lost Ark 1982 logic, if I'm younger and willing to go with it, I'd think, cool. And in my 30s, I see that movie and I think, are those guys, like, ancient and they're sort of reanimated, or are they contemporary and they, like, every morning go in there and, like, hide behind the walls and they pop out all, like, dirty to attack, like, Tomb Raiders? Anyway, okay, here's some things that I noted about this story. First page, great first panel. Kudos to Dab for writing this. Kudos to Seeley for drawing this. Great first panel. Great first page. It's almost wordless. It's got tons of mood, right? You just immediately know that the stakes are high. Something's going on. There is tension, right? There's a goal, right? And if you know Joe costumes, that first panel, you know those are not Joes. You know those are Cobras. Also, the cover and the story. Second panel is a great extension and expansion of the first panel. First panel gives you two or three pieces of information. Who, where, and how. And then the second panel expands that by 300%, right? There are a lot more of them. You get a lot more of where. And then with the three bits of flame and the smoke, you now know that the stakes are much higher, right? And then the third panel, right? They stop, chalk, chalk, chalk. People talk about, quote, widescreen comics. I think that term is helpful, but also sometimes sort of too much of an abbreviation, and maybe the term is overused. But this first page is quite cinematic. And that's not because the first two panels have very wide aspect ratios. The visual storytelling on this first page is great, right? Even if you take your finger and you cover up Frostbite's word balloon in the bottom panel, right? The page still completely sells it, right? I am bummed out and worried by panel four. Okay, so panel one's great, page one is great. On page six, someone says, modified Snowcat. And I thought, I wonder what that means. And I thought, oh, is this going to be some, like, vehicle from the middle 2000s where Hasbro took the original Snowcat and then put, like, three dumb additional missile launchers on it to make it like a new vehicle and then gave it some dumb new name because they'd lost the name Snowcat. And then on page 7, I just see the Snowcat and I think, A, cool, the Snowcat. That's my favorite Joe vehicle. Second place, Awestriker. B, I think that's a handsomely drawn Snowcat. And whether Seeley is holding the toy in front of him, took a photo of his toy, or is looking at the internet in 2006 for reference, like, well done, sir. C, I think, you know, I don't think we saw the Snowcat much in the Marvel comic. We certainly see it in a couple episodes of season 1 of the animated show, like in Haul Down the Heavens, where it's drawn very, very tall. And then I realized C becomes D, which is in the second panel of page 7. Oh, there are four people, maybe five. There are five people in the cockpit of the Snowcat. That must be how it's been modified, because the toy only carries two. And then I look back at the first panel and I think, is Seeley drawing it sort of the cockpit like longer or taller, as if it could fit two rows of seats? I can't quite tell, but I still think it's a nice drawing.
They also hark back to, on the previous page, they hark back to the last time that the Joes were in a sort of Arctic environment like this in the early issue, the second arc of Frontline. Scarlet says to Snake Eyes, it's just like Norway, isn't it? You're not even cold. Asterix, G.I. Joe Frontline, issue 5, which is where a team of Joes sort of went to, you know, investigate these kind of abominable snowmen.
Dan Jolly genetic, monsters.
The Dan Jolly monsters.
What really makes this two-panel joke on page 6, where Scarlet says this and then walks away, oh, shut up. What really makes it is the combination of her expression. Her eyebrow is up, but she's sort of frowning dryly. And then as she walks away, Snake Eyes' body language, which is so great because he's turning to see her go and his hands are slightly upturned in a, what did I do? Body language. And one of the fine lines that all G.I. Joe media walk, TV, movies, comics, I guess novels and audio plays, but is how much Snake Eyes communicates. And it's not that he can't, it's that he mostly doesn't. That's where I've landed, because he could write stuff. And, you know, back in issue 5, Marvel issue 5, he does. And he can like write stuff in the snow or the sand with his finger. He does in, is it 144, you know, Charlie Mike. And, you know, he could like pick up a tablet and type stuff. He could learn sign language. If he knows sign language, he could use it. And yet writers over and over and over sort of choose to have him not communicate much, which I think is a really cool decision. It's because he's more of a blank canvas. You know, like you ask him a question, what is it? Is it a Marvel story or is it a Devil's Due story where Scarlet asks him a question and he doesn't do anything and then she turns away and she says, you never answer? What am I thinking of?
Not sure.
So the fact that he has this like little bit of body language here, like he is responding, but he's kind of not responding, makes it really funny. So that's a nice bit. Page 11. Tomax's costume is terrible. I think I've said this before. Yep. I can't remember if it was when they showed up in the Red Shadows or we saw a data desk profile of them. I understand that their original costumes are flamboyant and silly and a little overdone. You know, it's like they got a cobra on their chest. They got a cobra on their crotch. They got a cobra as their knee pads. And there's just a little bit of noodling. There's just a little bit of like bits in the boots. There's just a little bit of like ridges for the cobra sort of belly, or like how their belts are a little complicated, bolts on the one collar, right? I think the original Tomax and Zaymot costumes, as with a lot of Ron Rudat designs from those first 7 years, I think they are sublimely balanced. right? Whether it's like a little military, a little sort of advanced military, or a little sci-fi or a little fantasy. And here you have these like James Bond Star Wars villains, but they're like circus acrobats, right? And you know, like the collar and the one shoulder gets a silver thing on it, but the other shoulder is bare. It's like, that's weird. But then you have them next to each other and they're symmetrical. Okay. So this costume on page 11 of Special Missions Antarctica, this is like someone saw the original costume and described it to someone else who had never seen G.I. Joe and also was trying to have them redesign it, but leaving out a lot of the interesting stuff. This costume looks like it's 45% developed. And there are some Devils Due redesigns in, you know, 2001 and on, where I don't like the costumes. Sometimes there's too much, sometimes there's too little, and ugh, it's not a good costume. Page 13, panel 4. So after Tomac's toast, just turn the page. There's this wordless page, it's two pages later, with snow serpents on the top, Stalker looking, the Joes walking, and then there's a big panel on the bottom, and they're heading towards the tripod oil drill thing, which, by the way, looks like an invented machine. I can't believe that's actually what an oil drill would look like, but I could be wrong.
I'm pretty confident predicting that real oil drills are not like a sort of giant mechanical spider.
It's not the villain from Wild Wild West.
Exactly.
It's not the giant machine from the end of the Will Smith movie with Kevin Kline. It's not the spider that couldn't be in Superman Lives. Okay. So this panel where we're behind the Joes as they're heading towards this oil drill thing, Scarlet's pose here to me is a good example of how I have been hard on some of Tim Seeley's drawing, some of his poses, some of his panel compositions. There's a page in How to Draw Comics the Marvel Way, the seminal how-to book by Stan Lee and John Buscema, and in it, Buscema draws someone punching in like 12 stages of the full motion, but it's just a stick figure. And he starts with sort of the cock back, and then has the like dun dun dun, and then the midpoint, and then like dun dun dun, the like final sweep, the bit of the movement. And in animation terms, he's drawing extremes and in-betweens. And Stan Lee in his captions is making the point that you want to draw like that, the first one or the last one. And you don't want to draw the ones in the middle. They don't have enough oomph. It's like either it's all kinetic energy, like the punch at the end, or it's all potential energy, the like wind up at the beginning. And Scarlet's pose here is very much in the middle of that. It's like she's sort of running. She's sort of turning. She's sort of... And like two panels earlier, when Seeley just draws Stalker looking from around a corner with his finger up, like wait, or sort of pointing, like that's totally fine. And on the previous page, when a couple Joes are kneeling and Duke says, Scarlet, Frostbite, Iceberg, Stalker and I will take care of the oil rig. It's like, that's fine. I don't need like a lot of attention there. But at the beginning of the episode, I was lauding Francis Manapul's pose for all the characters on the cover, and I focused on Snowjob. I mean, just compare Snowjob on the cover, and I know it's a different kind of pose, but to Scarlet here on page 13. Shall I continue with some observations?
Yeah.
Okay. Page 18. It starts with an explosion. It's six panels. It starts with an explosion. Whack-hoom! And then Duke says, move! We gotta stay ahead of them. And then I sort of couldn't tell what was happening on the final two panels of this page. So Frostbite says, you're going to have to arm the charges manually, Iceberg. And Iceberg says, no problem. And then he runs, and there's some on the top, in all four corners of the panel, there's some speed lines showing that like something's moving away from us or something's moving toward us. And then in the final panel, he's like grabbed on to this leg and there's speed lines behind him and he's like holding on and his breath is getting pushed. What is actually happening here?
I think it must be that the oil drill spider is walking on its mechanical legs and that mechanical legs is sort of moving away from him and up. So he's sort of grabbing, running after it and grabbing onto it as it's moving away from him.
And then swings him up and then he can let go at the peak.
Exactly. Yeah. So he sort of attaches or drops a bomb and then sort of falls down and away from it.
I don't think the storytelling is clear enough to communicate all of that. I got in a broad sense that Iceberg is somehow physically getting to and interfacing with the crisscrossy metal thing, the leg, but I sort of lost track of like which one, because on the first panel of that page, one of them seems to be exploding, or where its leg connects to the sort of main body is exploding. It's like, oh, are they at the next one? You know, like in that second panel where Duke says, move, we got to stay ahead of them. If on his left side, he was lit like with bright yellow, then I would think, oh, okay, they're turning away from the thing that just exploded and now they're running to the next one. Or if the camera pulled back and I could see like one burning on the left or like in the foreground between us and Duke. Anyway, I don't think Seeley, I think he needed a little more space on the page, like a third panel to show this sort of like circus acrobat thing, like this Batman, Spider-Man, you know, jumping, thwipping, swinging thing.
Right.
Almost there. Okay, page 27. Tomax gets in the drill tank. And I'm a big fan of drill tanks. Very happy to say that there are drill tanks in G.I. Joe comics. There are drill tanks in G.I. Joe animation. There are drill tanks in live-action G.I. Joe movies. And because of that, there are drill tanks as toys. Makes me very happy. Drill tanks make me happy. The top of page 27, Tomax is holding a remote control. And he's in this cockpit and he says, I'm afraid I must bid you adieu, but feel free to enjoy the entertainment. And then he drives away. And between him and that word balloon on the side of this giant like warehouse Quonset hut, there's this like 30-foot by 30-foot like TV screen, computer monitor, which has been established. I'm not picking it at that. That's how he orders his workers to keep like drilling. Like we've seen on previous pages, like video footage of his face on several of these warehouse Quonset huts, like in a row. But I don't quite understand sort of what he's doing in putting on, is this like, it's like the villain at the end of the James Bond movie ties up James Bond and like the laser buzzsaw is coming at him. And he's like, allow me to turn on this TV so you can see the closed circuit video footage of your girlfriend about to be eaten by alligators. Farewell, Mr. Bond. Is that what he's doing? Because the footage on the screen here on the top of page 27 is this like a comp of a panel from a previous? Yes, it's a reused panel from two pages earlier where the Joes are being chased by a bunch of snow serpents who are not using their guns. And it seems to me like, it's like, Tomax, do you actually have time to do this? Like, let me turn on the TV and find the station for the one camera that's aiming. Like, I know I'm thinking too hard about this. And it's like, no, Tim, this is like a silly comic book cartoon. Just enjoy it. And I like the general idea that Tomax is rubbing it in their faces. But A, I don't think this is the way to do it. And B, because the panel, because the TV, the giant warehouse-sized TV in this panel is so small, and then the detail of the artwork that it's reusing is so tiny, I didn't quite know what was going on.
Mm-hmm. No, that's fair. I guess the story logic as to why he might do it, it would be less about rubbing their faces in it, perhaps more like, your friends are in jeopardy. You've got a choice to make. Do you come after me or do you rescue your friends? Yeah, which isn't really stated, but, you know, is the outcome.
You know what? Going back to why the Cobras don't shoot at the Joes, there's that panel, which is the one that gets reused on the TV.
Yeah.
And I note in that panel, the Joes are running right towards a pipe. So, yes, I think there is some visual logic for why the snow serpents aren't shooting at them, because the Joes are standing 4 feet in front of a pipe. I guess my last comment about this story is that on page 25, so the page that has the Stalker igniting the pipeline, and it's just fine. Stalker's face, I very much appreciate when artists can draw different kinds of faces. Like, I don't mind when, like, Bruce Wayne and Superman, Bruce Wayne and Clark Kent have, like, the same face, just give them slightly different hair. Like, that's fine. Drawing comics is hard. It's okay to have stock faces. But, you know, Stalker's got different lips than the other characters in the story, and Stalker has a different nose, and those are black features. So in terms of the specificity, I appreciate it. In terms of just the differentiation, I appreciate it. And I actually sort of wondered, looking at this panel, there's a little Mike Norton in both faces, and I thought a little less Tim Seeley. And so I sort of that made me think, like, well, one, I think Robert Atkins is a good inker for Tim Seeley. I think he's adding a little pep here and there, a little heft, even though we don't think of Robert Atkins as an inker now. But also, Mike Norton is not credited in any special way in this issue. He's not in the masthead. Huh. Well, this is late 2006. Is this when the company had started to get smaller? Anyway, I sort of, looking at that panel and some of the faces in the later pages of the story, I sort of wondered if someone else did a little bit of work because of deadlines or what. And if this is all Seeley, then I apologize. It looks great. Faces look great in this.
Very good. I had just one small extra I Spy to call out, which is just that we've got the Ice Vipers using their size, which are, you know, these sort of dagger type things that they randomly came with as accessories in the packet, along with the Cobra Wolf. So, yeah, sort of fun to see them actually making appearance in the story.
Not the only G.I. Joe vehicle driver to get to use their weapon in the story, in fact.
True.
My I Spy is on page 22. Frostbite gets to use his sniper rifle, which is very exciting for me because as a kid, did I mention the Snowcat is my favorite Joe vehicle? My brother and I noted with great interest that its vehicle driver came with a weapon, which generally never happened in G.I. Joe, right? Because the logic is they're sitting in a giant weapon. And I haven't checked Frostbite's Marvel appearances today, but I'm guessing this is Frostbite's weapons first, or certainly one of the very, very few.
Yeah, this sort of like really cool M16 with this giant sort of scope attached to it. It was one of the very coolest of the G.I. Joe early figures accessories.
Yeah, and is it slightly out of scale? Is it like a little too? Is it 10% too big?
Slightly oversized. Yeah. It's a lot more muscular than say the M16 that came with Footloose, for example.
Yeah. So then the profiles,
which are fine. The lettering is very small and difficult to read. And I'm old, you know, just reading. It was a struggle to try and make my way through this this text.
And again, medium blue on medium gray. That's not high contrast.
Yeah.
Like compare that to the yellow on dark gray above it. I just want to point out Seeley and Atkins draw these, and in Frostbite's drawing, he's holding car keys, which is cute and funny.
Then next up, we have the second story, which is called Tactical Benefit, but perhaps could have been called Special Mission to Hawaii. Writer, editor, Mike O'Sullivan. Pencils, Joe Dodd. Inks, Clayton Brown and Richard Zajic. Colors, Jean-Francois Belliot again. Letters, Brian J. Crowley. And inspiration, advisor, Sam Damon. Now, Sam Damon's someone that you know, right, Tim?
Sam Damon is a collector of G.I. Joe figures and vehicles. He's very interested in, his collection is very big, and he's gotten big into the international stuff and variations. Sam Damon is the founder and owner of Joe Declassified, which is a nonprofit that seeks to collect and display pre-production and rare G.I. Joe artwork. Joe Declassified tends to have tables at conventions like Assembly Required and Joe Fest, but the stuff isn't for sale. It's like prototypes and concept art. It's mostly toy, very, very little animation or comics. And it's like a traveling museum. So there's always sort of different stuff on display at these conventions. Sam Damon is in real life a Navy SEAL.
And also pal of writer-editor Mike O'Sullivan.
Yes, yes. And Sam Damon did a little consulting on... Have we seen his name in credits yet in our reading of all the Devils Do stuff?
I can't remember it cropping up to this point. I don't think it has.
So I don't know... I don't know at what point he gets credit, and if it's like inside front cover credit or if it's like here, story credits credit. Sam Damon was a military consultant for a bunch of Devil's Due stories where he was reading scripts and making comments on if stuff was accurate or making suggestions. And I think because he was friends with Mike O'Sullivan, I think he may have been a sounding board for some of Mike O'Sullivan's stories. Good. I've one more eyes by. Back to the first story. Sorry, I didn't do this earlier. On page 24, when Snake Eyes and Snow Job crash through a window, Snow Job, no shirt. Feel like he might get some scratches on his arms. Anyway. They jump out the window and land on Tomax's claw, which is sort of on fire because then it spirals down and it's smoking. And Tomax yells, "You fools, you'll kill us all." I feel like that might be sort of two references to the animated series, because in the first miniseries, when Duke escapes Cobra Temple, and he uses the Falcon glider. I can't remember. Maybe he like jumps off of his and lands on a Cobra's Falcon glider. But also in, I think it's episode 5 or the end of episode 4, the first miniseries, Scarlet is in this weird little made up jet plane spaceship thing. And she and Destro were in the cockpit and she blasts the controls and the plane goes into a spiral. And I think Destro says, "You fool, you'll kill us all, or you'll kill us both." And that may be not a direct reference to either of those. It may be that if you put 100 monkeys in a room with 100 typewriters, 7 of them are going to come up with G.I. Joe stories where someone involves a flying vehicle and someone else jumps on it. But knowing how much the Devil's Due comics look to the cartoon, this bit here feels like it could be a reference.
Let's get into the story.
Plot breakdown.
Wetsuit and torpedo are dropped in by a shark. That's the G.I. Joe vehicle, not a friendly aquatic animal. To join a U.S. Navy SEAL team that is attacking a Cobra facility in Hawaii. They run into Medivipers, making them think that they might expect to see Scalpel, the Cobra chief medical officer. Scalpel does indeed show, and the Joes are able to overcome him. An inspection of this Cobra medical facility begins, and there is an off-panel discovery made of a mysterious person tied to a hospital bed. Later, on an aircraft carrier off the coast, the G.I. Joe team arrives from their Antarctic mission. Duke is given a report which he passes on to General Colton. Wetsuit and Torpedo were able to capture Scalpel, Overkill, Monkey Wrench, Dr. Biggles Jones, the DePain brothers, and the most important captive of all, a comatose Zaymot. They are to be brought back to the Joe's base at The Rock. What did you think of this one, Tim?
Less successful. So for those of you listening who haven't read the story, I want to sort of respond to how Mark just summarized the story, because that bit about Overkill, Monkey Wrench, Dr. Briggles Jones, the DePayne brothers, mm-hmm. that's one word balloon on the final page. Those characters are not in this story. Mm. And so I was going to get to this later, but we can cover it now.
I think it's almost the biggest part of the story, this single speech bubble. It's a little bit strange.
Yeah, because the story seems to be going in a different direction. Like, the first page is underwater, and then the second and third page are, like, creeping up to a building and in a, you know, Navy SEAL kind of way. But then they're all wearing masks, and they all look like Shockwave in a, like, SWAT way. They, like, break into a building, and then...
And this was one of my observations, was like, they all look very similar. And I don't think any of them are Beachhead, but they all look like Beachhead.
Also, one of them looks like Snake Eyes. On page, so when I do page numbers, I'm going from the first page of this story. So okay. This is an 8-page story. I'm only referring to pages 1 through 8. I'm not counting from the beginning of this comic book. So on page 3 of this story, panel 2, they're all 5 of them are gathered around, and I can't really tell who's who, but now that I'm really looking, the 2 on the left are Wetsuit and Torpedo, and then there's one in the middle who's got a full mask and green night vision goggles, and then there's one on the top right who looks like Commando Snake Eyes from the first story, because he's got, like, Snake Eyes is sort of signature, like, black ribbed long sleeve sweater, and Snake Eyes is classic sort of visor. And the word balloon is kind of pointing up to that guy.
Yeah.
And so I thought, that's when I realized, also on page 2, right? Let's go back to, one additional page. In the third panel, two guys are walking away from us. Camera is on the ground looking down an alley. Up at two Joes, Torpedo and Wetsuit, walking towards, it's a little hard to tell, 4 silhouettes of people crouching. And someone in the distance says, "Torpedo, Wetsuit." And Torpedo says, "Hey, Chief." And Wetsuit says, "What's the situation?" And then I thought, oh, I guess this must be like Duke and the Arctic guys. Because on the final page of the previous story, there's this joke about how this whole team is going to go to Hawaii and have this next adventure. And now I'm reading this next adventure. And then like one panel later, I see 4 guys in a circle, and they're sort of underlit by, I can't tell what, a flashlight or like a glowing laptop. That's okay. I'm not going to pick on that, but their faces are all sort of, you know, light green, which is fine. And the 2 on the left, it's like, okay, I think the one on the far left is Wetsuit, and then there's, like, I don't know, Hit and Run or Tunnel Rat, and then there's, excuse me, Torpedo, and then, I don't know, Hit and Run or Tunnel Rat, and then Wetsuit, and then, I don't know, Duke with camo in his face. And then I realized, I don't know if the story knows who these guys are. And then on the final page, page 8, in this big info dump that Duke has, where he's talking into his headset, in the second panel, he says, "Torpedo, Wetsuit, and the non-Joe SEALs had things well in hand." And I thought, oh, okay, those other 3 or 4 guys were non-player characters. And that's okay. Certainly, you know, like, there are lots of G.I. Joe comics by the guy who's written a lot of them and the other guys who've written a lot of them, where the Joes meet up with a contact or someone who's not a Joe becomes a recurring character. You know, Billy, Tyrone, the Blind Master, Pale Peony, you know, Dr. Burkhart, right? These characters. Okay, so who's the bear? Who's Ripcord's girlfriend?
Candy. Bongo the Balloon Bear.
So, like, that's not sort of breaking any G.I. Joe rules. And I can see... like, no, there would be some stories where a Joe squad teams up with a non Joe's squad of specialists and experts. It's like, oh, we're going to meet up with, you know, the 432nd mechanized division, and we're going to ride their tanks into Sierra Gordo. And then you have a couple panels where like three Joes are talking to some non-player characters, or like, we're going to meet up with like one CIA agent. It's like, there are a couple issues of special missions like that. Or like, who's our contact? It's like, oh, he's a local like fixer. He'll like change your money and drive you around. But this felt like sort of proportionately too much. It's like, no, don't have the other four guys be non-Joes. Have it be four Joes, or like three Joes and one non-Joe SEAL. And then I realize, oh, I don't think this 8-page story has enough breathing room for Torpedo and Wetsuit and four other guys, and then also Scalpel, and then also Duke, which is, I think, why we get this big info dump on the last page. The last page has a lot of word balloons. It's not offensive, but it's definitely too many for a page. And it definitely starts to feel like, oh, this really wanted to be a 10-page story, and the ending gets, you know, sort of compressed.
Yeah, yeah. And maybe the story could have been told without the seals in it at all, but that dialogue box, Torpedo, Wetsuit, and the non-Joe seals seems to be doing a lot of heavy lifting of acknowledging that perhaps the preceding pages didn't really make it very clear who was who and who specifically who was helping Torpedo and Wetsuit. So let's just call it out to be completely clear as to what was going on with that team in a dialogue box.
And in that second panel on the final page, we do see, I think that's Torpedo on the far left, and then just above Duke's hand, someone, Frostbite, Stalker, someone, Snowjob, Wetsuit, Torpedo, someone, Scarlet, Snake Eyes. So this does link up from the end of the previous story. And then there's this third panel on this final page where, okay, so Duke says, we're still taking an inventory of what we got, including prisoners. And then on the third panel, he says, Overkill, Monkey Wrench, Dr. Wiggles Jones, the DePayne brothers. Why any of them were in medical care is still being determined. We're going over records now. And I thought, okay, two panels later, he's going to mention Zaymot, and they're going to show him very, very small. And then it ties back in with, okay, that's why Tomax was by himself in the previous story. And, you know, we haven't seen them in a while. Like, okay, interesting. This story would be as clear and as effective if you just took out the word balloon where Duke is listing 1, 2, 3, 4 big deal, like marquee G.I. Joe characters. It's like, there have been times previously in the Devil's Due run when we felt like something was sort of being crammed in dialogue. And it wasn't always at the end of the issue, but like, it either felt like a story got cut short or a story had to change partway through. And since in the previous pages, the Joes see one person in a hospital bed, and the artist, penciler Joe Dodd, goes to like some lengths to not show us who they see, which I think is what the script is calling for, and that works, right? And Shockwave and Shockwave on that page say, is that? Looks like it. Wow, sure didn't expect that. And I'm thinking, who is it? Who is it? I have to turn the page and find out. And then I find out it's Zaymot. I think, oh, that's interesting. That does hook up with the previous story where Zaymot was conspicuously missing and Tomax was either like crazy talking because Zaymot wasn't in the room or something. But like Overkill, like, I don't remember when we last saw him, but there was something big about him being introduced in the Devil's Due run around the 20s. And then he like came back bigger and better. And then like Monkey Wrench, it's like, okay, well, I don't remember when he left the story or was injured, but he's a Dreadnought and the Dreadnoughts have been a big deal. And then Dr. Biggles Jones, like Dr. Biggles Jones, that's the scientist who's in the Transformers crossover in Marvel 139 through 142. And I can't remember if we've seen her in the Devil's Due run, but
no,
we've not. It's like, wait, this is her debut? And then the Payne brothers, like, okay, well, I don't remember who those guys are. Is it the three guys in issue 95 who like are going to torture Snake Eyes, Marvel 95? And
yeah,
that's how that's how Snake Eyes gets his third costume.
The three S&M guy brothers that
right, and then they don't show up again until the cover of 300.
Right.
So like, this is fun. This is when an Easter egg moves to a kind of fan service that undoes itself, because it starts to, it's such a tease, it's actually really distracting and then disappointing. It's like, wait, Dr. Biggles Jones? Are you going to use her? No. What? Did we get to see her? No. a page ago, was there at least like a hallway with lots of doors and names on them, and one of them says Dr. Biggles Jones, like in an episode of some Batman show, when like there's only one villain of the episode, but Batman goes to Arkham and there are hints of all the other villains who are in Arkham? No. Well, then why have Dr. Biggles Jones even mentioned? And then it reminds me, while I'm comparing this to sour feelings I have when a G.I. Joe story calls out someone and I feel like the writer is trying too hard. It's like in The Rise of Cobra when that scientist gets called Dr. Mindbender. And we all know that's not Dr. Mindbender. And that's not even some like stand-in or like proto Dr. Mindbender who's not really Dr. Mindbender. That's just some scientist. And the screenwriter's like, huh, what's a G.I. Joe name I can use here to make some G.I. Joe fans happy? I'll just pick one. Oh, did I pick wrong? Well, who cares? This is a terrible movie. So...
The odd thing about Dr. Biggles Jones is that we, in the pages of G.I. Joe, we last saw her being captured and going into space with Megatron. And then I think in the very early issues of Transformers, I think it's called Transformers G2 or something like that, the Joes, out of Hammer continuity, he didn't write it, go into space and rescue her, or some such. I think she returned to Earth. But then we never hear of her again, so it's very random that she's introduced here. I wonder if possibly whether that's a mistake, and that they actually wanted it to be Dr. Knox,
Dr. Amelia Burkhart. Oh, sorry,
no, not Dr. Amelia Burkhart, Dr. Knox, who was actually on the Cobra team during the Jawa run, and you know who she was working on the Tempest device. And so, you know, she was in amongst those Cobras who we've not seen up for a little while, like Scalpel and Tomax and Zaymot, you know, blah, blah, blah. And so I suspect that might have been an accident, that they just picked the wrong doctor. Overkill was last seen in Players and Pawns Part 5, which was issue 31, where he was in a fight with Snake Eyes and sort of a little bit pitiful at the end of it. He was sort of saying, kill me, you know, sort of suffering sort of in that kind of new transformed cybernetic form. Yeah, I think what they're doing here is just moving around some collateral and sort of, you know, putting some tools in the kit for potentially future stories, that if they've got some key Cobras who are in custody and back on the back on the table to be played with, that you know they're there should a future writer want to have a wider cast of Cobras to play with.
Yes, that so as irked as I sound about this final page, I do think it's also okay to drop a seed, and maybe it'll blossom, grow. Maybe another writer will pick it up. But just as a graphical exercise, everyone, just look at this final page. The word balloons really stand out. There's a lot of dialogue, and it's all from one guy. And, just compare that to, like, the two previous pages. And, you know, those are action pages. They're not man on deck talking over the phone pages. But...
And if you remember, when we just spoke to editor Mike O'Sullivan about Special Missions, The Enemy, he was talking about how much that story kind of changed between the original script and intent behind it versus what the story ended up being. I wonder if something potentially like that happened here, and all of this dialogue is kind of slightly telling a slightly different story to perhaps the one that was originally intended. I know I'll get Mark of the future to ask Mike O'Sullivan and then insert what he says here.
Hey guys, thanks for the question about Special Missions Antarctica, the backup story. Got some answers for you. No behind the scenes drama, really. Sam Damon and I just wanted to tell a story that was as true to real life SEAL missions as possible. Sam was the one who told me all about it and how they actually went, so we wanted to be as truthful to that as possible. He said it's basically quiet moments and a lot of waiting that are briefly punctuated with violence, and then afterward, lots of discussion, lots of reports, debriefing, and the bigwigs talking through everything. So the pacing of that story was intentional. There wasn't any Hasbro or page count interference. It was meant to feel like an actual SEAL mission and how it feels to the participants. The randomness of the characters at the end of the story, that was all Sam and I too. We wanted to scrape the bottom of the barrel to give some interesting Easter eggs for fans, long-time Joe fans, especially characters that would likely never be seen again or their stories never given any sort of resolution. Monkey Wrench was chosen intentionally to set up Zartan's later actions in World War III, and Zaymot was included to tie up his last appearance in the Rise of the Red Shadow storyline. He hadn't been seen since then, so we thought it was good to kind of give his story a bookend. Thanks for the questions. Hope that gives a little bit of insight into that story.
Mark of the future here, thanking Mike O'Sullivan for setting the record straight. And back over to Tim from the past.
Let me say something positive and say something negative. The first page of this story is very good. Like the first page of the Antarctica story at the beginning of the comic, it has several panels and sort of moves across some space, and there isn't as much urgency and there isn't as much visual storytelling, but there's a good amount of visual storytelling, right? Shark, organic organism, shark with mystery light above it. Shark passes, mystery light gets closer. If you know G.I. Joe vehicles, you might actually recognize that rectangle with little line through it as a particular sticker. And then the shark with a C, not a K, which is just as the first page in Antarctica is a cinematic page with good visual storytelling, so is this. This is a nice bit of a visual comparison. Hey, everyone, and you did it. Hey, it's a shark. Oh, it's a shark. And then it's actually really hard to tell, but are they holding on to the back bottom of the shark in the fourth panel?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, they're okay. Sort of being dragged along, and then they, I guess, let go and they're left.
Okay. Because the toy actually has the pegs for backs. You can stick two Joes on the bottom of the shark. I think in the animated series, don't they like fill up the inside and then they like put on their masks and they open the cockpit and they just swim out? Anyway, so there's some unknown third Joe in the story who's piloting the shark, unless this is a modified shark and it has five seats in it, in which case there are five other Joes in the story. And then you get a little bit of a, like, miniature pinup panel, you know, like a sexy panel on the bottom of this first page with this very clear, cool drawing of these two Joes coming at you. They're not obstructed. They're not turned away from you. They're not covered by smoke or word balloons. It's like cool Joe doing his thing in costume, cool Joe doing his thing in costume. So I really like this first page. And then the second and third page, the word balloons are really small. And at first I thought this was a production error, like maybe the letterer had made a mistake and all the lettering was just 20 or 30% smaller than normal. No one caught it. And then I realized, oh, I think they're whispering. And I am a fan. There are different ways in lettering in comics to show that people are whispering. And my favorite is what I think is the sort of old-fashioned one, which is what I first saw, which is the actual oval outline of a word balloon is a dashed broken line. And another way to do it is to make the black outline and the black letters gray, which I think is a good idea that doesn't ever work. So to me, that's a no. And then another one is to make lettering small. And That works much of the time when it's still big enough to read or the letters aren't like compressed enough. So like, you know, I'm starting to look at all these letter E's, like A, B, C, D, E on this page. And the E's just start to like become like eights, just start to become little like solid boxes. I think if it was like one word per word balloon. Anyway, okay, so I don't love the lettering on pages 2 and 3. And then on pages 4 and 5, then I realize that penciler Joe Dodd is not quite up to the task of drawing this story. First panel on page 4. In a previous episode, I talked about lowering the horizon line, and this is a good example. This panel where these two Joes come up on these two black silhouettes, there isn't any drama or tension to it because the camera is at it's at like 8 feet looking down at everyone. And then on the next page, when Shockwave jumps away from Scalpel while Scalpel is sort of shooting at us, it's the panel that where suddenly everything is orange, not blue. You know, it's sort of this pose doesn't quite work. The distance from Scalpel doesn't quite work. The like oomph of the lunge doesn't quite work. The straight on-ness of the doorway that Scalpel's in doesn't quite work. It's just not a great drawing. It's just not like the composition. I mean, look at the cover, right? Go back to all these body twisting, tension, exertion, action poses on the cover, right? And then, you know, it's like, okay, this doesn't quite work.
I was just looking at this sequence and sort of tracking the changes of Scalper's gun. So he comes through the doorway and is shooting with what must be a pistol, because we can only just see like a burst of flame coming out of his hand. Next panel, it looks like a, you know, rifle that possibly with a stock to it in his arm. The next panel, sort of silhouette, can't really see very much. Next panel again, it's an AK-47 without a stock on it at all. Next panel, he's getting his gun kicked out of his hand, I think, by Torpedo, and it's back with a stock on it again. So it's sort of that weapon that he's using is virtually different on virtually every panel that appears.
I think it's possible that's like the script calls for him to sort of like reach behind back into the doorway and grab a different gun when you turn the page, and now he's got this sawed off AK-47. But I agree with your point about inconsistency here. What really saves this story, and I like this story. I think the story, I think it needs a second pass. I think fewer elements or a couple more pages and less dialogue on the final page. But I think the actual plotting of having, you know, two Joe Seals go meet up with someone, and then it's a specific character who I've always been interested in. You know, it's this like invented Cobra. Because Scalpel, remind me, Hama invents the Metaviper around issue 130, right? Hama and Andrew Wildman around 125 or 130 or 135 invent the Metaviper. And the way that, you know, Hama invented the Kitchen Viper in the backup of is it yearbook 3 or yearbook 4, My Dinner with Serpentor, where Serpentor is calling for, you know, the Kitchen Vipers to, you know, like bring out the food or make the food better, right? Like, that's just a little joke. But in the Marvel comic, like, debuts this sort of side character, this legion of kinds of vipers. Anyway, and then remind me, Mark, at some point in the Devil's Due run, does Devil's Due invent Scalpel?
I think it's a toy invention, I believe, that then is featured in the comic, like from that Venom versus Valor type era. So Scalpel came out in 2003 as part of the Spy Troops era of G.I. Joe toys, and funnily enough, his body was reused to create the Medi-Viper, who was released as an online exclusive
in 2005.
Okay. And I haven't read his file card, but he's like the head of the Metavipers, or he's been gone up through the ranks of the Metavipers. You know, the Joes have Doc and Lifeline and Stretcher. So cool. So I like that they get him. I like that there's a surprise at who else they get. But I think the story needs to sort of dial back its scope. And, you know, as hard as I am on Joe Dodd's artwork on some of those middle pages, the final page is quite handsome. And the real winner for this whole comic book, first story and second story, the thing that just icing on the cake of the first story and actually kind of saves the second story, is the color work of Jean-Francois Beaulieu. He works with Scotty Young, who's drawn a lot of comics at Marvel. And he has done some Devils Do Joe stuff that we've covered before. It's not just that the first story is cel-shaded. It's not just that the second story is also cel-shaded. It's that they're both done really well in terms of leading the eye, highlights. Everything is sort of pretty or neutral. Things aren't like inadvertently distracting. There aren't, it's just good colors, both stories. And the pinups.
Right. I think we're at the end of this story. And that also means the end of the entire comic. Let's wrap it up with a Yo-Joe-age score.
It's Yo-Joe-age time.
I'll go first. 5, for all the reasons that I said. Good story. I would do it a little differently. Nice art. Great color. Okay story. Okay art. Needs some reworking. Great color.
Yeah, I think that's all fair. I'm probably going as a 6, just because I'm, I think, more generous with these things. Great cover. The art's pretty good. Colors are also very good. I like the sort of straightforward nature of the romp of the snow-based mission. I thought that the second story was a little bit flawed, let's say, the short version of everything we've discussed already. But, a solid book all round.
Postbox bit, this is where you can send in your thoughts. Mark and Tim will hear it, and then we'll discuss it. It's really nice to hear from our biggest fans.
To leave the show a voicemail, you can contact us via the voicemail facility, which is at the bottom of our website, talkingjoe.co.uk. Scroll down to the bottom and there is a button to leave us a message. That is what Rusty did. So let's hear what he had to say.
Hey, Mark. Hey, Tim. This is Rusty, currently enjoying the Sierras in Arnold, California. I'm calling about Special Missions Antarctica. For me, this qualifies as a totally solid issue. The art's great, and I love seeing special teams get put together. Cobra's menacing, but their plot is still a little bit crazy and fun. I like how Devils Do will tease us with these mysteries, like why the Crimson Twins are separated. The backup story, where the Joes interact with a vanilla special ops team, is interesting too, although it does make me realize why I often can't get into other war comics. It can be really tough to tell everyone apart when they're wearing the same uniform. Finally, one thing I was super excited to see was the Data Desk Handbook on Torpedo. For almost 40 years, I've wondered if that was Snake Eyes or Torpedo on the cover of Special Missions Number 1, and the Data Desk entry finally answered that for me. I hope you both have a great new year, and thanks for all the work you put into the show.
Okay, so next time on Talking Joe Disavowed, we will continue our side quest away from the main America's Elite book, with a look at some of the specials that were coming out around 2007. Next up will be Special Missions Brazil from May 2007. And then we'll have a look at the G.I. Joe versus Transformers books before heading back to the main America's Elite run. And over on our other coverage, we'll continue to look at G.I. Joe, Real American Hero from Larry Hama as they come out. And we will also be taking a look at the Skybound Energon Universe books as well. So Duke, Cobra Commander, and all the rest as they happen. So, Tim, where can people find you when you are not talking to me about G.I. Joe comics?
Video essays from my creative partners and I at our YouTube channel, Atomic Abe Productions. My brick-and-mortar comic book store in Somerville, Massachusetts, is Hub Comics. And I write about G.I. Joe at arealamericanbook.com.
Excellent stuff. You can find more about Talking Joe at the usual places. TalkingJoe.co.uk is the website that has links to all of those places. You can find us on Facebook, on Twitter, on Instagram. We are also on Patreon at patreon.com/TalkingJoe. So a big thanks to all our backers: Richard, Sam, Jay, Bill, Christopher, Justin, Rob, Brian, and Shane, who are all getting early access to episodes as well as some exclusive content. And that is us done for now. But remember that
nobody beats Talking Joe, an international podcast.
Laters.